From WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, this is Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, April 24. At their meeting yesterday, the Sarasota County Commissioners voted 5-0 to cut ties with the United Way. Arguing that the United Way Suncoast 211 helpline lists Planned Parenthood as a resource, Commissioners Mike Moran and Neil Rainford led the charge to end a payroll deduction program for county employees. A second resolution passed by the commissioners terminates county funding for any organization that provides referrals to organizations which provide abortion services and information, and mentioned 211 as an example. The vote came after a Herald Tribune report that found that no 211 referrals were made to Planned Parenthood last year. The end of payroll deductions affects not only the United Way Suncoast, but also the smaller United Way of South Sarasota, as well as all the other nonprofits that obtain funding through United Way workplace fundraising. Last fall, the county commission led by Moran voted to defund the 211 helpline. Moran has been arguing the helpline, as well as other social services, should be entirely funded through charity and private donations. In March, the United Way Suncoast announced it would stop providing 211 services to Sarasota residents, blaming the end of tax funding. Moran interpreted this as an attack and proceeded with his initiative to end payroll deductions. A third Democrat has filed to run for the Sarasota County Public Hospital Board, which governs Sarasota Memorial Hospital. Alan Jerome Sprince is retired and lives in the city of Sarasota. He served as a hospital administrator in the Chicago area. The Democrats will be up for election in November after Republican contenders battle it out in a closed primary for three of the four hospital board districts. In these primaries, four Republican medical freedom challengers are facing more mainstream Republican incumbents plus one new candidate. Sprince said he wants to stop the gutting of public hospitals after they are privatized. Medical freedom activists who are opposed to masking and vaccination mandates have threatened to privatize Sarasota Memorial Hospital. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Wednesday, April 24th.
Necessarily reflect those of the management team, board of directors, or any of the volunteers affiliated with the station. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. We've got some great guests today. First part of the show are two guests, Scott Osborne and Fran Palmieri. Scott, you should remember, she's been on our show several times. She runs the Through Women's Eyes Film Festival each year. Does some other things besides, but she's also been a lawyer, a Peace Corps volunteer, a Montessori high school teacher, a nonprofit director, a grant writer, a gender equality advocate, and quite a few more things. And she's an athlete to boot. And she's a mother and has lived in seven countries. And she has moved and started a new life 24 times over 35 years. Wow. In honor of Earth Day, which was last Monday, Scott has brought with her her Fran Palmieri, a nature photographer and author. So, Scott, please introduce Fran.
Thank you. And thank you, Tom. And thanks for the plug for our film festival, which finished its 25th year. But today we are talking about Earth and nature. And I think that's a great topic for the Peace and Justice Report, because I think those are very much peace and justice issues, and we have a wonderful person with us today to talk about. Fran Palmieri is the author of two books so far, A Bouquet of Days and Florida Lost and Found, both of which I own, and she's at work on a third, which we're going to hear about. So her authordom is wonderful. She was a journalist to begin with and then got into photography, but really considers herself a naturalist. She fell in love with Florida in 1950 and moved here in the 1990s. And Fran has been on the Sarasota Tree Advisory Council, the Friends of Oscar Shearer Park. She's a Florida master naturalist and has worked also on creating a video for the Sarasota Centennial some years ago to introduce people to the green spaces and the nature that we have with us. She's also been known throughout the rest of Florida, not just Sarasota, and has walked and photographed in every single county in the state of Florida, which I think is fascinating. And Fran was also a Peace Corps volunteer, which of course makes her near and dear to my heart in West Africa, which is a fantastic accomplishment. So we're going to talk about many of these things. Welcome, Fran.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you. So tell me first, I know you consider yourself a naturalist. You've done many things. You're an author, you're a photographer, you're a journalist. But now I think that sounds like it's most near and dear to your heart. What do you mean by being a naturalist?
Oh, I would say basically being in nature and observing, recording. I do photograph, getting out there, learning. It is constantly a learning experience. Just feeling the joy and healing of nature.
And I know you feel very strongly that everyone should get out and should appreciate pieces of nature. Could you say a little more about that? What do you think people should do who are maybe kind of suburbanized now, as so many people are? I know you think this is very important for us as well as for nature and for the planet.
Oh, absolutely. Just getting out as often as possible. Even gardening, being in your own backyard, growing some plants that will pull in butterflies, that will bring you joy. It's the beauty of nature that I appreciate so much, and everyone can appreciate, especially kids. You know, bring your children, bring your grandparents. Vitalizing, boosts your creativity, builds hope in these times, and dispels fear. It's just wonderful.
Can we go back to that issue of fear a minute? When you and I talked one day, we talked about how many people today have more fear of nature and wild spaces and perhaps wild animals. They don't feel as comfortable perhaps out in, you know, Mayaka Park or Oscar Shearer Park. I know, you know, you feel that it's important that we learn how to manage this. Could you say a little bit about that and about, you know, what it's like being with, whether it's snakes or alligators or whatever things people might fear?
Yeah. I've been out most days for about 20 years. And at first, when I happened to come across like a black racer, that's a snake in Oscar Shearer, I looked for the nearest tree, you know, was I going to get away? And animals run away from you. They're afraid of us. There is really very little to fear. Once I was between an alligator on one side, and he was a good-sized fella, and then Eastern Diamondback rattlesnake on the other. And I had read one of my so-called dead mentors, William Bartram, that he found these animals magnanimous. And that's what came into my brain as I'm looking at this big snake. He just looked me over and went on his way. And that's what they do. There's just very little to fear. I've maybe some of the animals that we brought here ourselves, like the feral pigs. But the other thing is, if you respect the animals, they feel the same way towards you. And ordinarily, they're just trying to live their lives. So, yeah.
Thank you. Tell me a little bit about walking in every county in Florida. This got my curiosity going. What prompted you to do that, and what did you see?
I just wanted to see everything. I started at Oscar Scheer State Park in 2004. And actually, I met Laurel Schiller at the gate. She's people may know her. She's been a planning commissioner in Sarasota and part of the Florida Native Plants Nursery. And I happen to know the combination to the gate because I went so often. And so I told her, we went down to the Nature Center. She did a program on connectivity, which I'd never heard of. So learning is a part of being out there, reading books, going to programs, meeting people, talking to people. And then I did Oscar Scheer, then I did the county parks. We have wonderful county parks here. And then I just branched out. Hey, what's beyond Sarasota and Manatee County? And so I went to the surrounding counties. And then I went to Gainesville for a while, stayed with friends up there, and was able to do the north part of Florida. I did the panhandle because I wanted to see the pitcher plants bloom, which they bloom around May 1st. So that's a wonderful thing to do. So I just, it just kind of spread out. One day I was driving along and I saw a sign to Okefenokee. And so I went north through the northern part of the panhandle. I spent time around the Jacksonville area. So, yeah, you just kind of, your curiosity just builds the more you get out. There are wonderful books to read. I started with Audubon's Guide to Florida, and then I read Priceless Florida. I had wonderful mentors, John Beckner from who had worked at Selby and knew the flora very well. We went out for 2.5 years, just about every day. He wanted to go out every day, and so did I. So that worked. So.
Well, Fran, you wrote a book, Florida Lost and Found, Discovering Natural Places in the Changing Landscape, about all the places in Florida. Is this still a useful guide, do you think, to help people see Florida?
I think it is. I think we have seen changes happening, but I think the basics are there. There are not there's not as much wildlife because humans chop the trees down, bring in a bulldozer, and build a house. So loss of habitat is a big concern for me because when I first went out, wow, you know. Lots and lots of wildlife, and now it's less.
And so, Fran, tell us a little bit about the forthcoming book.
I'm holding it up, but you.
Oh, nice cover. It looks green. And what is the plant we see on the front of those? I can't tell from here. What is the plant?
These are Philippi roses.
Okay.
Philippe. Rose, and that had a very interesting journey coming to Florida too. That has been naturalized. I liked it because it looked a bit like the title, which is Tapestry. This is the three books I've done, Florida Lost and Found, Bouquet of Days, and Tapestry, are a trilogy of essays and photographs, and I wrote them for everyone, for children. Children can read these or be read to, all the way up. And I, they're small, so you can put them in your backpack, and or just have them around to read in the evening. People have told me that nature is calming. Nature represents peace to them.
And the name of that new book?
Tapestry.
Okay. And the other one is A Bouquet of Days?
Bouquet of Days, yeah.
Rambles through the natural beauties of Florida.
That's right. Yeah.
And these are all available on Amazon and through your website. Is that right? FranPalmieri.com?
Yes. Tapestry is not up yet. It will be up in the
fall.
But
it will be, yeah.
Right. But yes. And I also did, I have another book up on Amazon, Florida Wildflowers. And these are just photographs of, well, all the flowers are beautiful to me, but I picked out colorful flowers with butterflies, and so just kind of a delight.
Lovely. So, Fran, tell me about this work for the centennial of Sarasota.
Yeah, the county asked me to do a video, a narrated video, on my work, walking around, photographing what I saw. And so I put it together, and it's a green pilgrimage. And I consider this the pilgrimage is a journey. And this has been a journey in my life, a very, very important journey. I'm in my mid-80s now, and still going strong. I've got a great person looking after my health, Cynthia Clark, and my sister, Carol Knight, helps me with fine editing. She's my comma queen. And Rachel Brown Hackney has been my longtime editor at the Sarasota News Leader. So I've got these wonderful people supporting me.
She's great.
I know you said, you talked to me a little bit about getting out in nature helps remind us that we're just sort of one of 8 million species. And tell me more what you think that really does for us and how you came to see that. Because, I mean, I think that way, but I don't think most people think that way. People think of humans as very separate and distinct from all the other living things on the planet.
That was the biggest lesson I've learned in all these years. The first lesson was connectivity, that we are all connected. We are nature, and we're connected with the rest of nature, which is why it's vital to preserve natural places. But we've considered ourselves top dog, and that hasn't worked out. high rate of extinction. Dr. Edward Wilson, the Harvard biologist, a very recognized person, two Pulitzer Prizes, an ant guy. Well, actually, he died some years ago, but he also was very concerned that we see ourselves just as one of 8 billion species, not the, in charge. Because I think we can do a better job.
Fran Palmieri, you mentioned, I was looking at your website, so you mentioned one area I've never heard of, the Fakahatchee Strand. That is the Amazon of North America here in Florida. That piqued my curiosity. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, that's south of us. near Naples. It's east of Naples. And I discovered that many years ago. I bought a Delorme map book and just kind of, you know, got out there. It's a 20-mile long track, and it's a state park.
Mm-hmm.
Just absolutely fascinating. It was timbered out about 80 years ago, but the land came back,
mm-hmm.
and it 50 native orchids have been identified there. It's just, it has a dirt road through it. Mm-hmm. So you drive through it, get out and look around. Lots and lots of trees, open areas. Absolutely fascinating.
And, what's the name of it?
Fakahatchee Strand.
Fakahatchee. Fakahatchee. It's really part of the larger Everglades area.
Thank you.
Area. But it's interesting. So, Fran, if you had one place to recommend to us listening today to go out and see, what would it be? Just go down to Oscar Schurer State Park, or just go in, what do you think is a good outing for us older people, a way to get out and see nature? Any particular recommendations?
Yeah, I've got a couple. Certainly Oscar Schurer State Park is very family friendly, comfortable walking trails, lots to see. You can walk 3 miles or half a mile or not. You can just sit. You know, and watch the sunset through. I watched the sunset through the pines. Myakka River State Park, quite a bit bigger. Another wonderful state park with lots of opportunities and lots of alligators. Hey, you want to see an alligator? You go to state park and you stand on the bridge, especially now when the water is low.
When the water gets low and you're in your canoe, sometimes you have to get out and pull that canoe, and the alligators watch you from about 10 feet away. it's a little disconcerting.
Yeah, but they go on their way too.
Yes, they do go on their way. They definitely go on their way.
And so, Fran, I know you were a writer when you started, but then you got into photography to really bring that into the books. And how did that change how you saw nature? I know people sometimes talk about, you know, when they get a camera in front of them, they see things differently. What was it like for you? I mean, you started photography before the digital age, I'm assuming.
Yeah, actually, I revived my old career. I was a photographic stringer for the Washington Star in the 60s. And then I moved to Africa and lost my Nikons on the beach.
Oh, man.
It just got taken. And I was really crushed. I gave it up for 40 years. And I was buying a camera for my daughter, who was in at Savannah College of Art and Design. And I held the camera and I said, I've got to do this again. And that was, I can't remember, but about 2000. And yeah. And then I just couldn't put it down.
Well,
so, hey, you know.
We've had photographers on the show before, and I would recommend, I don't know if you've done it yet. I don't think so. I would recommend putting a few of your favorites up on your website, so people can look at them, even if they don't buy the book, and can enjoy the beauty of them. Just a suggestion.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they are there. They're supposed to be there, and I'll check.
Oh, really? Okay. That website is?
It's franpalmieri.com. I think there's a gallery. Is there not, Fran?
Yes,
check, Tom. I think there's a gallery of essays and photos, no?
Yes.
Yes, I was wrong.
I don't know.
There, They're a beautiful gallery of different photos and different collections. So franpalmeri.com, franpalmeri.com. Yes, I was wrong about that. So thank you, Fran, for those beautiful pictures.
Oh, thank you.
So which you like more, Fran, the photos or the writing? Because I know your books, they're really unlike some photography books where you feel you're getting captions. Your writing is really very lyrical, and it brings a feel of nature into the actual words. So is that where your heart is or not?
It's so hard to say. I get into both things, but I love doing books. I want to just tell people, you know, if you have a book in mind, I know you, Scott, are working on two books, and that's very exciting. Do it. It's fun. It's satisfying. I guess photographing, because I still photograph every day. I've got hundreds of thousands of photographs. And just
Interesting. Talk a little more about how animals act toward humans. I know you said they sort of go their own way, but what have you observed in all these hours and probably accumulated months or years sitting in nature? I mean, what do you think they're thinking of us?
We started taking over the land 10,000 years ago when we, you know, with agriculture coming in. And since then, I think they've come to realize that, over hunting, we've been hunting them. They're afraid of us. People ask me, oh, you know, are you afraid to get out there? No, never been attacked by a wild animal. Never even just, being face to face with a diamondback was certainly disconcerting. But, you have to learn etiquette. You don't look these creatures in the eye. You're quiet. If you see a big animal, you stand still and observe. So, and then you begin to have this kind of relationship with these animals. After all, we are nature. Mm-hmm. We grew up in nature. We evolved in nature. And the other thing is the respect I feel, because a lot of these, like the gopher tortoises, have been here much, much longer. And the alligators, wow, they go way back.
Sometimes, you know, we have to remind ourselves that when we see a scrub jay or other species here in town or in the suburbs, we're in their neighborhood. They didn't move, and they have to make do, and they've lived there for many generations. We've had people on the show who followed scrub, for instance, those jays, for many generations. They tag them, and they understand it's whole families that lived here. And when you build buildings in their area, they don't move. They have to make do. You know, it's quite, you wrote that you've seen Florida, watch natural Florida disappear parcel by parcel. And it reminds me that, you know, we're visitors in that sense. But we could do more. In Berkeley, California, for instance, where my daughter lives, all the front yards are wild. And every front yard is totally different. Different kinds of plants, trees, all the grasses are waist high or whatever. They respect nature as opposed to manicured lawns and fertilizer and so forth, which I would like to see more of here in Florida.
Oh, I would too. That would be huge. If we could get rid of the notion of the manicured, fertilized, pesticide development, we would go a long way, because I don't know what you think, Fran. We're not going to reclaim all our wild spaces, but we can take the greenery surrounding all of our homes and turn those into mini wild spaces.
Yes, absolutely. Especially if you put in plants that butterflies recognize, and nectar off of, and Absolutely. I lived in New York for a while and was delighted to see all the roof gardens. And just a tiny little space, you know?
10 feet by 10 feet with the right kind of flowers can attract insects and birds and be a better home for our partners on this earth. I totally agree with you.
That's right. That's right. And help stem the loss of these creatures. It's being said now that we're losing animals and plants that haven't even been discovered yet. So
yes,
think what we can do as people. I think the also it's very important to be hopeful, to not give in to the either I'm done or it's done. You know, just abandon that. And enjoy and have fun. These are all so vitalizing.
Thank you, Fran. Thank you so much. And your books are Florida Lost and Found, Tapestry is coming out, and A Bouquet of Days. And keep doing what you're doing. We're very grateful and very much in debt, and it's inspirational for everyone.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. I'm so delighted to talk to both of you today.
That's Fran Palmieri you're listening to. She's the author of A Bouquet of Days, Rambles Through the Natural Beauties of Florida. And interviewing her was Scott Osborne, who's been on our show many times. And we appreciate both of you being here. And thank you for encouraging us to get outside and get outdoors. I'll try to go out today. And I'll remember what you said. And I'll look at your photographs also on your website. So thank you both.
Thank you for having us. Take care.
Okay. See you later. Bob.
Yes, Tom. Yeah, I had the pleasure of interviewing a longtime friend of mine a few weeks back. And her name is Adrienne Scott. And she's a tribal member, originally from New York City, an educator and editor, currently a content writer for the Pocasset Poconoket Land Trust. She was the first Black Indigenous person of color news reporter for WPRI-TV in Providence, Rhode Island, and the first Black Indigenous person of color female in the market, and later did public relations work in healthcare and business. And she taught English composition, language, and literacy in community college, adult education centers, and tutoring programs in Boston and Northern California, which she focused on Indigenous youth. And she currently lives in Sacramento, California. And so the conversation we had was related to the Indigenous Food Sovereignty Program. It serves marginalized Black Indigenous people of color communities in Rhode Island and Connecticut by teaching people how to grow their own medicine through herbs, fruits, and vegetables. And the farming techniques are traditional Native American and never use chemical fertilizers or pesticides. Huh. And so I spoke to Adrienne about two or three weeks back. And I know you have the interview there, right, Tom?
I do. I can play it in just a second. How did you happen to find her? How did you discover her?
Well, she's a longtime friend, but we were talking on the phone a couple of months ago, okay. And she had mentioned how she received this grant to do a documentary on the Indigenous Food Sovereignty Program. And I said, oh, that sounds like a good subject for the Peace and Justice Report.
Perfect. Let's play it. Then when it ends, we'll talk a little bit more. Here we go.
Okay.
So, Adrienne, tell us about the Indigenous Roots Forever Food Sovereignty Program and how you happen to get involved with it.
Well, yes, thanks, Bob. Thanks so much for giving me some time to talk about this marvelous program. I was thinking I'd back up and just kind of let your audience know a little bit about the the program being a part of a larger program, which is a part of a 501c3. So I'll start with the 501c3 that drafted me from almost complete retirement a couple of years ago, happens to be my family's Native American tribal roots. And it is called the Pocasset Wampanoag of the Pokanoket Nation. And I have a cousin, and this is back in the land of your roots, Massachusetts and Rhode Island, both states where my parents were born and raised, that did the echo historical delving into the ancestry using an echo historian to document our direct descendancy from the chief of the Wampanoag tribe that helped the pilgrims to stay alive. And we're talking in the 1600s. People don't know that there were some English colonists who came even before the pilgrims. And so the skirmishes, the attempts to make make cooperative living a success, meaning one of the 67 tribes in Massachusetts at the time that the English colonists came were trying just to survive in a peaceable way. And so that's how the whole situation with the pilgrims came about. It was really at the point at which they came, they were exhausted. And so they were just trying to figure out how to manage. And so they weren't necessarily being friendly or warlike. They were kind of neutral, but they figured, okay, this is the best possible scenario. Now, they didn't figure on getting their land taken away bit by bit. We also have documentation of that, by the way, but land treaties that were written in English, which was not the Algonquin languages of the Wampanoag, with land arrangements that were definitely suspicious. And then eventually in the 19th century and 20th century, eminent domain. So that's how we lost the land. And in the very late 1600s, there was a war that was really the colonists' reaction to just deciding to go all out and burn down villages. And it was actually, historians call it, the most destructive war on the shores of America ever. And I think they're considering the Civil War too. And it's called the King Philip's War, because the son of my ancestor, Massasoit, took the English name to pacify the English, and it was King Philip. But that was his native name was Metacomet, I believe. So that's a little bit of the history. But in an effort 20-something years ago, my cousin decided to sort of delve into this history and figure out what he could do for all of us tribal descendants, some of whom are scattered, but mostly the ones that are in Massachusetts and Rhode Island who had nothing, Bob. They had no land left. You know, unlike tribes in the center of the country and in California, where I am now, there wasn't even, there was a small reservation, and that is in the area, it's called Watupa, and it's very close to Fall River, Massachusetts. And we call it our reservation. It's less than 20 acres, I believe, but it's got the historic marker on it where our people were centered. But, you know, even though we had much more land, but at least we could call that. But it's nothing that we could build homes on, we could raise crops on. You know, we just didn't have that. So my cousin said, I'm going to try to figure out what we can do for the Black and Indigenous, both farmers who were trying to make a living at the time, who have our blood in them, you know, or have experiences very similar to ours. But the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, historically discriminated against them. They couldn't get loans. And so they lost their farms. That's the other part of what I'll be describing is why my cousin wanted to help. Because even those people in Massachusetts and Rhode Island who, and Connecticut really, I mean, all up and down New England, there were farmers. There were people who were raising produce and livestock. And if I gave you the statistics, it would just depress you of how we lost those farms too over time. But anyway, so just a few years ago, he was able to incorporate, and it's called the Pocasset Pokanoket Land Trust. And it's dedicated to preserving Indigenous culture and to supporting the Native people in the Northeast. And he and all of us who have been working with him is all about partnerships with other tribes, because we're talking about from Maine to Connecticut, right? There are so many different tribes. And when we decided to start writing grants, it made sense to partner with them. So we're talking about the Abenaki in Maine, all the way to the Narragansett in Rhode Island and Connecticut. The organization, we can't even give you a count of how many tribal members because we're so spread out. But I can tell you that in the effort to at least identify some of the lands that we want to continue to repatriate, we're getting 60 acres shortly after a lot of struggle with Bally's Casino, which is on tribal land, or I should say ancestral land, hoping to be restored to us in Tiverton, Rhode Island, which is right on the line, Rhode Island, Massachusetts. And we got the state of Rhode Island to pay the taxes from a private landowner. So that'll be 60 acres, which we should have in our hands by June. And then we'd be looking at some land in the Freetown, Massachusetts area, which is over the line a little bit into Massachusetts. Now, based on that work that they did 20 odd years ago, we've been able to, through USDA grants and private charitable foundations, form the Indigenous Roots Forever program. Indigenous Roots Forever was really a way that my cousin, I should say his name, Chief Sekwon Pajiki, also known as Chief Spring Buffalo, he thought, well, let me create a sort of a sub project that can also be a grantee, but will have more of a specific, not so much the farms and the agriculture, but the projects. And that is how, under its auspices, the Food Access or Food Sovereignty Program was born. That was one of the first programs I wrote grants for. And the wonderful thing about that was it wasn't big. It was designed for starting with 20 families, but it was designed to start during the pandemic, actually, to help tribal members who were living on the edge anyway, you know, basically check to check families, you know, to try to grow their own food. So we were able to, I think because growing your own garden, starting your own garden became a big thing during the pandemic. We were fortunate to get donations starting with tools, seeds, sometimes even heritage seeds too. But we didn't have enough money to pay the wonderful Narragansett tribal member who is a descendant of many generations of tribal techniques that are climate smart, being recognized more and more as being climate friendly. He is the knowledge keeper, and he became the lead on the project, but we didn't have enough money to pay him full time. So with some of me coming on 2 years ago, some of the grant writing, Bank of Newport is an example of pioneering into trying to bring our message to private sources. We were able to bring him on full time, and we had 20 gardens going in, mostly in Southern Rhode Island, that were raising primarily what we call the three sisters, squash, beans, and corn. And those were the staples hundreds of years ago. In our case, some people say we, you know, native people were on our land 30,000 years ago, but on our own land, I should say. But I'd like to see all the different guesses at the number of years. But that staple of the three sisters, because they're, I guess you could say, biochemically balanced. You know, the corn supports the beans when they grow up, and the potassium, I believe, that the squash emits underground helps to nourish. But today, I can tell you the names of the families who are growing them in Rhode Island and on the border of Connecticut because of this wonderful descendant named Rocky Johnson, who is a man of steel. I mean, he just travels to all of these locations, some of which, you know, some of the folks don't own their own homes, Bob. You know, they live in apartment complexes, but he finds a way. He'll build a raised bed. He'll get the apartment to approve it, and then repay their generosity with vegetables, you know. And in some cases, actually in one case that I know of, there's a catering company, indigenous owned, that has benefited. They've been in and out of being able to support the business, but I believe they're doing fairly well now. So anyway, his name is Rocky Johnson, but that's an example.
I just wanted to ask about the 60 acres. So is that going to be mostly farmland, or is it going to be any land to build homes on it?
That's a great question. That was my first question too. And it is, I keep saying unfortunately, but I shouldn't. It is mostly marsh, but it's also, it's forested. It's right, it's abutting urban, you know, areas, you know, because it's in that Fall River area. But because it is some of it's fairly well forested, there could be nature walks. There could be perhaps a nature center built into it, or some of the marsh could be filled in, and perhaps there could be some limited building, but that would take more money. Yeah, so the plans are pretty up in the air, except to we're going to make a video, and that's one of the things I'll talk about, that I've been brought on also to help to make videos to get out to the public the information about what we're inviting people to see and to feel when they know that they're on land that belonged to us and that we're inviting them to have the experience on. Thanks for asking.
We got about 4 or 5 minutes left, Adrian. So however much you can fit into that time period would be great.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I'll just go right into when I mentioned being brought on to do videos, because I was a former Providence, Rhode Island news reporter, I still have a little bit of memory about how to identify really good parts of interviews for public consumption and help my videographer cousin, who's a member of the tribe, to create videos. And we got a grant from the Massachusetts Foundation for the Humanities for $20,000 to create a 30-minute, what we would call a documentary. And the subject was something that was close to my heart, and it's called Red and Black, the dilemma of the African-American indigenous identity. And it was really only a question about what is it like for people like me who have been only African American identified, both mostly personally, not exclusively, but didn't have a lot of knowledge about my Indigenous side, and very much by people who look at me. And what we found, Bob, was tremendous. We're just in the part of the point of editing now, but it will be released at Nichols College on the Dudley, Massachusetts campus in October, and then we'll go viral. And it is about six or seven people, their interviews from age 88 to 13, about what it's like to be misidentified mostly, because people don't think of Indigenous culture existing in the Northeast. So...
I didn't realize for, you know, I had known you now for, I don't know, 30, 35 years or so, but which Native American are you as compared to African American? Do you know exactly?
Well, and that's another mystery. I have done 23andMe, and because that was only matrilineal, you know, it was only from my mother, the number's very low. It's 7%. But we know that if my brother did it, it would be more, because my mother has Narragansett blood, my father has Wampanoag blood. So my guess would be at least 25%, probably.
Yeah. When I found out, I said, oh, yes, you definitely have a Native American look. I mean, I don't know what it is, but I mean, I could see it once I realized it.
And what I didn't, just to sort of whet appetites about this documentary project, there is a descendant in this group of interviewees who is the five times great nephew, and I'm getting that wrong, but anyway, he's a descendant of a person of color in the country. In the late 1600s, early 1700s, who became not only a whaling captain, he was the owner of a fleet of whaling ships, because he started out as the son of an emancipated slave from West Africa and a Wampanoag woman from Cape Cod. Their story is quintessentially American, because his business sense was to hire and pay formerly enslaved and Indigenous men, and then hook up with the Quakers, who were enslavers too, but had to be convinced, you know, and he eventually became a Quaker. And then he started working as an abolitionist, went to Europe. I mean, his story is amazing. And his name was Paul Cuffey, and he will be his descendant, Robert Cox, or Chief Running Elk, or Nij Pajiquat Mose. He will be in the literally talking to us in the documentary.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, this is kind of like a preview to the documentary, because we only have another minute or so left here. So once the documentary comes out, I can talk to you a little bit, and we can let the people know it did come out, and give a little overall review and summarize what the documentary is about, in case some of the people haven't heard this interview today.
Oh, I would love that. I would love that, because to give some context, and also to, you know, if they want to be involved in some way, the message of the documentary will be everyone has a right to be identified the way they want to be, and that everyone should be proud of their roots. We want to make that sort of a message to everyone. And if they're interested, I can give the website, which will...
Yes, by all means.
Okay. It is PocassetLandTrust.org, and I will spell that. So Pocasset is P-O-C-A-S-S-E-T, and then it's Land Trust. And that's all one word, .org. And that has great. All our news on it.
Great, great, great. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on today, Adrian. And we'll look forward to having you back when the documentary is done. And
What?
Oh, okay. I think that was the end, Bob. But
yes, that was it.
What a great interview. Thanks, Bob, for that. And we'll keep up with that in that documentary and so forth when it comes out.
No, Tom, I'd like to read something only because it's related to what Adrian was talking about in terms of so many Native American tribes. And when I lived on Cape Cod, the next town from me was Mashpee. And Mashpee had many Wampanoag Native Americans there. But I just pulled this up on the internet just to read a couple of paragraphs about the Wampanoag tribe. But the Wampanoag are one of many nations of people all over North America who were here long before any Europeans arrived and have survived until today. Many people use the word Indian to describe us, but we prefer to be called Native people. Our name Wampanoag means people of the first light. In the 1600s, we had as many as 40,000 people in 67 villages that made up the Wampanoag Nation. These villages covered the territory along the east coast as far as Wakasset, all of which in today it's called Weymouth, but all of what is now Cape Cod and the islands of Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, and southeast as far as Bristol and Warren, Rhode Island. So we have been living on this part of Turtle Island for over 15,000 years. The Wampanoag, like many other Native people, often referred to the earth as Turtle Island. And today, 4,000 to 5,000 Wampanoag live in New England, and there are multiple Wampanoag communities all throughout New England. And recently it was also discovered that some of our relations in the Caribbean islands, and the people are descendants of Native Wampanoag people who were sent into slavery after the war between the Wampanoag and English. We as people still continue our way of life through oral traditions, the telling of our family and nation's history, ceremonies, the Wampanoag language, song and dance, social gatherings, hunting and fishing. So I thought that was interesting only because there are still many Native Americans throughout the country, we know that, but in New England, and this program that Adrian is involved in is quite substantial in terms of what it's doing for the people, bringing them back to the land and growing their own crops organically, and reuniting the whole story of Native Americans. And of course, she was talking about Black Indigenous people of color. So they're not only Native American, the people that she was talking about, but they're also Black.
And how did they come to be Black? Was that an early immigration of slaves, or were Native Americans Black themselves? I don't quite get that connection.
I didn't ask her. I should have asked her that question.
Yeah. Well, let's find out. You know, once a year we have the Native American Film Festival, and we'll be sure to cover that when it comes up again. And it teaches us that, you know, this land is not really ours, right? It was somebody else's for many thousands of years. And we're guests here, so to speak. Even though we now own it, we should respect it, respect that heritage.
You're 100% correct. And, you know, that's when the white man came into the United States and began what they continue to do all around the world today.
Yeah. But it doesn't have to continue exactly like that. Anyway, thank you for discovering her and that heritage. And we should have more programs about what did they say? It's not Native Americans, Native
indigenous peoples. Yeah, the indigenous.
Right. Yeah. Same thing with Australia and other places, which we have to work to give them back some of what they had. Okay, so it's time to stay tuned for Democracy Now!, which starts at 10 o'clock, one of the best international news shows that I know of, with Amy Goodman. And you're listening, of course, to WSLR 96.5 LP, low power FM in Sarasota.